December 23rd, 1993. Consett, England. 25-year-old delivery driver Paul Logan brings a food order from a Chinese takeaway restaurant to a remote farm, but when he arrives, the property's owners inform him that they never placed the order. When Paul attempts to leave, he is ambushed at the farm's gate and bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. It becomes apparent that the takeaway order was a setup to lure Paul to his death, but even though rumors circulate that he was murdered by someone with a personal grudge against him, no one is ever charged with the crime. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be traveling to the United Kingdom to explore a pair of unsolved murders which took place 1 year apart, the 1993 murder of Paul Logan and the 1994 murder of Tracy Mertens. Per tradition, our podcast likes to spend the month of December covering cases which took place during the holiday season, and these crimes both took place 2 days before Christmas. While there's nothing to indicate that the two cases are connected, they each involve a victim who was murdered in a senselessly brutal fashion for reasons no one has ever been able to completely understand. Paul Logan was a delivery driver at a Chinese takeaway restaurant who was lured out to an isolated farm by an unknown individual who phoned in a fake food order, and Paul became the victim of a violent attack which was likely perpetrated by multiple people. While Paul was known for being a loving husband and father, he also had a reputation for being a tough guy who could easily make enemies, and prior to his death, there were warning signs that someone from the area had a personal vendetta against him which may have escalated into murder. As for Tracy Mertens, at the time of her death, she had recently moved to Rochdale with her spouse and two children, but after returning to her former residence in Birmingham, she was abducted by two unidentified black men. They then proceeded to take her to a 19th-century church in the village of Eton and poured a can of petrol over her body before setting her on fire, but Tracy somehow managed to survive for several hours and shared the details about what happened to her with police before she passed away. It's been suspected that Tracy's murder was somehow connected to a drug debt that her boyfriend owed at the time, but he always denied these allegations and claimed to have no idea why Tracy was targeted. One thing both of today's featured cases have in common is that there have always been rumors about people knowing a lot more about these crimes than they've let on, but they've never come forward with information, so the cases have remained unsolved for 3 decades. So on this episode, I'll start off by discussing Paul's case before I provide my theories and analysis, and then I'll move on to Tracy's murder. But before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access episodes, and bonus content, as our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. I also just wanted to mention that if we manage to reach our goal of 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of 2023, we will provide an additional extra special bonus to all of our patrons in January. In addition, I need to announce that this coming Saturday, December the 16th, we'll be holding one of our annual Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. It's taking place at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and if you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes and pinned to the top of our social media pages. Hope to see you there. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the murder of Paul Logan.
Thank you.
Our first story begins in 1993 in Consett, England, a town located in County Durham, which currently has a population of around 25,000. And as an aside, I'll just mention that perhaps the most famous individual ever born in Consett is the legendary comedian Rowan Atkinson, aka Mr. Bean. Consett is surrounded by a number of small villages, and our central figure here, 25-year-old Paul Logan, lives in the village of Blackhill with his common-law wife, Pamela Hughes. Even though they've never officially married, the couple have been together for nearly 10 years and have two children, a 4-year-old son named Michael and a 9-month-old infant daughter named Natalie. Paul has also spent the past 2 years working as a delivery driver for a Chinese takeaway restaurant called the Golden Flower, which is located in Shotley Bridge, another village which is a part of Consett. At around 9:20 p.m. on the evening of December the 23rd, the owner of the Golden Flower received a food order on the phone from a man who said he was calling from a location called Blue House Farm. The caller gave vague directions to the farm, which the owner didn't really understand, so they were asked to provide their phone number and were told that the delivery driver would call them back when the order was ready to go out. Well, sure enough, Paul called the number back 20 minutes later and was told that Blue House Farm was located on Newlands Road, about a mile away from Shotley Bridge. After being given specific directions to the farm, Paul left to deliver the order in his Peugeot brand automobile. When Paul arrived at Blue House Farm, he turned off the road onto a lengthy dirt lane and drove to the farmhouse, where he knocked on the front door at around 9:55 p.m. However, the owners of the farm, a married couple named George and Shirley Grosick, told Paul that they had not phoned the Golden Flower or ordered any food, so he got back into his car and drove away. Well, just over a half hour later, the Grosicks looked out one of their farmhouse windows and were surprised to see the lights from what appeared to be Paul's delivery vehicle, which was parked near the end of the dirt lane in the distance. This prompted the Grosicks to call the Golden Flower to inquire about what was going on, and since Paul had still not returned to the takeaway, the owners called his spouse, Pamela, to see if he had gone back home. Pamela had no idea where Paul was, and since his father, Hugh Logan, and brother David had not heard from him either, they decided to stop by the Golden Flower. After learning about Paul's delivery to Blue House Farm, Hugh and David went out there to search for him. When they arrived at the farm, Hugh and David discovered that Paul's abandoned car was parked at the end of the dirt lane next to Newlands Road. The vehicle's lights were still on and the doors were open, but there was no sign of Paul himself. While this was going on, the Grosicks called the police to inform them about what was happening, and since Blue House Farm was located just over the line which separated County Durham from County Northumberland, the investigation would be under the jurisdiction of the Northumbria Police. After the police arrived at the scene, they performed a search for Paul, which would be hampered by some heavy snowfall which was taking place. However, at 2:17 a.m. on Christmas Eve, Paul's body was discovered in a field about 50 yards from where his vehicle had been abandoned. He was bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument, possibly a baseball bat, though the murder weapon was never found. Paul had a total of 27 wounds on his body, 10 of which were on his head, and some of the wounds appeared to be defensive. The end of the dirt lane had a gate, but even though the Grosicks were certain that they had left it open that night, the gate was closed when Paul's father and brother first arrived at the scene. This led investigators to theorize that someone had closed the gate while Paul was speaking to the Grosicks at their farmhouse, and when Paul drove back to the end of the lane, he climbed out of his car in order to reopen the gate, but was ambushed. Since Paul's body was found 50 yards away, he likely made an attempt to run from his attacker before he was killed in the field. Paul also still had money on him, so robbery did not appear to be the motive for the murder. Indeed, the crime seemed to be personal in nature, and even though Paul was known for being a loving family man, he also had a reputation for being a tough guy with a tendency to make enemies. Paul's brother, Hugh Logan Jr., would tell the press, quote, "Paul was no angel, and like anybody else, he fell out with people. But if somebody falls out with someone, this is not what they deserve," end quote. Investigators learned that over 2 months prior to his death, there had been a 4-week period in which Paul's car was repeatedly vandalized. On one occasion, its tires were slashed, and on at least 2 occasions, scratches were made on the vehicle, and someone scrawled the words, "No legs," onto the roof. Paul made a number of inquiries to attempt to figure out who vandalized his car, and even offered one of his friends £500 if he could find out who did it, but as far as anyone could tell, Paul did not uncover the identity of the responsible party. It seemed apparent that whoever phoned in the food order to the Golden Flower had intentionally set up Paul to be killed. As you recall, this person had provided their phone number to the owner, and police wound up tracing this number to a phone box located on Snow's Green Road, only 600 meters away from the Golden Flower. After phoning in their order, the caller then apparently waited at the phone box for the next 20 minutes until Paul called them back, and they provided him with directions to Blue House Farm. Witnesses from the area would recall having seen a well-built white male in a black leather jacket hanging around the phone box that night, and at least one of them said that he was not actually using the phone. Based on their description, a composite sketch of this man was circulated by police. Witnesses also reported seeing a second well-built white male in a black leather jacket who was sitting in a red Ford Fiesta parked near the phone box, which seemed to indicate that multiple people were involved in Paul's murder. Police also announced that two men matching the description had been seen inside a blue Bedford van parked on Snow's Green Road on December the 3rd. They had aroused suspicion because they appeared to be watching the Golden Flower and scoping out the delivery drivers. If these two men were Paul's killers, then they may have been attempting to learn his routine so that they could ambush him 3 weeks later. Before Paul's car arrived at Blue House Farm on the night of the murder, witnesses had recalled seeing a red or orange-colored Astra brand car parked on a track about 150 yards away from the farm's entrance, though it was unclear if this vehicle had any connection to the crime. In February of 1994, Paul's case received nationwide coverage when it was featured on an episode of the popular BBC TV show Crime Watch. The episode showcased the composite sketch of the man seen outside the phone box, but even though a number of viewers phoned the tip line who believed they recognized him, none of the leads they provided went anywhere. Paul's family initially offered a £10,000 reward for information, and Crime Stoppers UK agreed to contribute an additional £5,000. Well, in the weeks following the Crime Watch episode, the British tabloid, The Sunday Sun, published an article which alleged that Paul may have been killed because he was under suspicion over his alleged involvement in a lucrative car ringing racket. It was revealed that Paul had once been charged and appeared in court for a pair of car thefts, but his father, Hugh Logan Sr., claimed that this was the result of a misunderstanding, as Paul had apparently purchased two cars from a garage in Newcastle which had fake documentation and he was unaware they had been stolen. Hugh stated, quote, "He did go to court like a lamb to the slaughter. He was set up like a sheep. He believed the cars were genuine. I can't remember what sense he got," end quote. I was unable to find any follow-up information about this angle, but this would not be the last time that allegations were shared about Paul's murder being connected to his involvement in organized crime, and I'll talk about this in more detail later on. Due to the nature of the investigation, the police had to hold on to Paul's body for several months before releasing him to the family, and he was finally laid to rest in Black Hill Cemetery, with a headstone featuring a ceramic picture of Paul over the inscription, "Murdered by Cowards." However, in September of 1995, it was discovered that Paul's headstone had been vandalized as someone chiseled a hole in the ceramic picture, causing additional grief for his loved ones. In December of that year, on the two-year anniversary of Paul's death, his mother, Elsie Logan, told the press that the holidays had been permanently ruined for her family, stating, quote, "There is no sign of Christmas in this house. There never will be again unless Paul's killers are caught," end quote. Over the years, rumors circulated throughout the area that a number of people knew who was responsible for the crime, but no one wanted to come forward. At one point, investigators announced that they were attempting to track down a man known only as Mr. X. He supposedly told some regulars at a local pub that he knew the identities of Paul's killers and a baseball bat had been the murder weapon, but I'm not sure if this guy was ever found. In June of 1997, it was announced that a total of 10 men were detained for questioning about Paul's murder, but they were released without charge. While very little information has been publicly shared about these men or why they were questioned, it would later come out that one of them was a Shotley Bridge resident named Keith Suddick. In November of 1998, Suddick was arrested for using a petrol bomb on a van which was parked outside the home of Paul's parents and belonged to his father, Hugh Logan Sr. Even stranger, it would turn out that the bombing had been orchestrated by a police constable named Jeff Hunt, who received a 3-month prison sentence for the charge of misconduct by a public official. Suddick himself received a 1-year prison sentence for the crime, and when he appeared in court, his defense attorney claimed that the attack had been motivated by the Logan family unjustly accusing him of involvement in Paul's murder, which caused his ceiling fitting business to fail. No evidence was ever found to implicate Sudduck in the crime, but a decade later, in January of 2009, he found himself in additional legal trouble when he received an 8-year prison sentence for arms dealing. Sudduck served just over 3 years of his sentence before he was released, but in October of 2012, he was found dead in the bathroom of his apartment at age 49 after suffering a fatal heart spasm brought on by acute and chronic cocaine use. Tragically, Paul's parents both passed away without receiving any answers about what happened to their son, as Hugh died in 2006 and Elsie followed suit in 2015. In 2017, Paul's sister, Dawn Logan McCants, made another public plea for people to come forward if they had information about his murder and announced that the family was increasing the amount of the reward they were offering to £50,000. In December of 2018, Paul's daughter Natalie, who was now 25 years old and the same age as Paul when he was murdered, made her own public plea for someone to come forward, as she said she finally wanted to receive justice for a father she never knew. But unfortunately, after nearly 30 years, there are still no conclusive answers about who was actually responsible for the murder of Paul Logan. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I know it's become a trope in true crime media for victims to be painted in the best possible light, which is definitely the best approach to take, but you'll often hear jokes about the usage of cliched phrases to describe these victims, such as, quote-unquote, they were the sort of person who lit up a room. Well, when researching the murder of Paul Logan, a phrase that the British press often used to describe him was a, quote-unquote, hard man, which is pretty much UK slang for tough guy. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean he was a bad guy, as it just sounds like he was the type of person who didn't take guff from anyone and could easily make enemies. While Paul's loved ones acknowledged that he was not perfect, they also described him as a devoted, caring family man who loved his wife and children. No matter what he may have done, he certainly did not deserve to be murdered, but it's possible there were some people living in the community at that time who felt differently. John Stalker, a constable from the Northumbria Police who worked on the investigation, would publish a special report about the case in the Sunday People newspaper in July of 1999, in which he wrote, quote, "Wrong as it is, a community sometimes sees the murder of a common enemy as a good deed. When the deed is done, the community locks its door on the world. This is what I believe happened in the case of Paul Logan," end quote. There's no doubt that Paul's murder was a premeditated crime, as it involved luring him out to a remote location to be bludgeoned to death, but the manner in which it was carried out was so risky that it seems surprising that it has managed to remain unsolved for 30 years. But if John Stalker's assessment is accurate, are there a number of people from the area who know the identity of the perpetrator or perpetrators, but have kept their mouths shut? And if so, are they remaining silent out of fear? Or do they just have their own personal reasons for not wanting the case to be solved? Given that Paul seemed like an ordinary husband and father who worked as a delivery driver for a Chinese takeaway, you might be wondering why he would be the target of such a premeditated setup. There are documented cases in which delivery drivers have been lured to remote locations and murdered by people who phoned in fake takeout orders, such as the 1984 murder of Morris Davis, which I covered way back on episode number 52 of this podcast. Sometimes this is done for the purposes of robbery, but that certainly didn't appear to be the motive here, since Paul still had money on him when he was found. I previously mentioned that in the early stages of the investigation, the Sunday Sun tabloid reported on allegations that Paul was part of a car ringing racket and had even gone to court for being in possession of a pair of stolen cars, though it's unclear if he ever did any serious jail time. During the same time period, it was also reported that police had traveled to Tenerife, a Spanish island which is part of the Canary Islands, to investigate rumors that Paul may have traveled back and forth from there as part of his so-called criminal activities. Of course, Paul's family found this completely ridiculous, as they claimed that he did not even have a passport and had never left England in his life, and investigators ultimately determined that the Tenerife angle was a dead end. But what made them think that Paul's murder was connected to organized crime? During an interview, Paul's sister Dawn said that rumors about this continue to spread to this day, and she has no idea where they came from. You'll also see Paul's murder get mentioned in a few books about organized crime, largely in connection to an infamous gangster named Viv Graham, who was heavily involved in extortion and racketeering. On New Year's Eve in 1993, Graham left a pub in the town of Wallsend when he was ambushed and fatally shot by an unidentified gunman. The crime remains unsolved to this day, and since Paul's murder took place only 8 days earlier, it seems like there has been an attempt to link these two cases together, even though Wallsend is located over 25 miles away from Consett. In fact, there have even been rumors that the same people may have been responsible for both murders, though there's a big difference between gunning down a notorious gangster and fatally bludgeoning a working-class takeaway delivery driver. A convicted criminal apparently once shared the names of Paul's two killers with the police, as one of them was supposedly an informant who was given a lot of leeway with their criminal activities by the authorities, while the other one was a violent offender who has served time in prison. There has also been a rumor that two men were paid £5,000 to beat Paul up, but got carried away and wound up killing him instead. I think one reason this organized crime angle has caught fire is because Keith Suddick, who would use a petrol bomb on Hugh Logan's van, was reportedly friends with some prominent gangland figures, including Viv Graham, but we'll talk more about Suddick in a little while. As it is right now, police have never officially confirmed that Paul was involved in organized crime or that illegal activity played a role in his murder. Myself, I'm inclined to think that this whole organized crime angle was nothing more than smoke and mirrors, and whoever murdered Paul did so for personal reasons. I mean, someone actually went to the trouble of desecrating Paul's headstone nearly 2 years after he was killed, which seems to indicate that they had an intense hatred towards him. There were a number of warning signs that someone was targeting Paul, since his car was vandalized on no less than 3 occasions in the months prior to his death. I've always been curious about the message that was carved into the vehicle's roof, "No legs." While it could be construed as a threat that someone was planning to cripple Paul by breaking his legs, that doesn't match the circumstances of how he was murdered, since he was bludgeoned to death and his legs were not targeted. The phrase, "no legs," is often used to describe something which doesn't have any chance of long-term success, such as a film having a good opening weekend at the box office, but then quickly falling down the charts and fading from the spotlight. I'm not entirely sure how this phrase would apply to Paul's situation, but then again, we can't even be certain that the message was scrawled by the person who killed him. It's been reported that Paul made a number of inquiries to find out who vandalized his car, and even paid a friend money to identify the perpetrator. But I'd be curious to know if Paul had his own personal suspicions about who did this, and if he ever shared them with his family. If he did, then that information has never been released publicly by law enforcement. One thing which is clear is that investigators have always suspected that multiple people were involved in Paul's murder, and the prime suspects seem to be the two unidentified men seen with the red Ford Fiesta at the phone box where the fake delivery order was called in. We also have reports of two men matching their descriptions, watching over the golden flower 3 weeks before the crime took place, and if they were the same men, then this suggests that they were scouting Paul's routine as a delivery driver in order to formulate a plan to ambush him. But these two men were seen in a blue Bedford van rather than a red Ford Fiesta, so it's possible they were entirely different people and have no connection to the case. Like I previously mentioned, there are documented cases in which people have phoned in a fake delivery order to lure drivers out to a specific location and kill them, but this is one of the most brazen examples I've ever seen, since Paul was lured to someone else's private property. I've seen no indication that the owners of Blue House Farm, George and Shirley Grosick, were ever considered to be suspects in Paul's murder, so I have to assume that investigators cleared them of any involvement. But since the Grosicks took the initiative to call the Golden Flower and the police after looking out the window and noticing Paul's car parked near their gate, the perpetrators were lucky that the Grosicks didn't see them as well. So here's how this murder plot apparently unfolded. The perpetrators called in the delivery order from a phone box located down the street from the Golden Flower, and also went so far as to provide the phone box's number to the owner so that Paul could call them back to receive directions. This whole process might sound odd now, but you have to remember that this was way back in 1993, long before the days of GPS or smartphones or apps or whatnot, and cell phones were also pretty rare, so organizing a delivery to a remote rural area would sometimes require direct communication with the driver to instruct them where to go. I get the impression that Paul was the only delivery driver employed by the Golden Flower, because if he wasn't, then the perpetrators got lucky that another driver wasn't assigned to deliver their order. I also have to assume that they were familiar with the layout of Blue House Farm, even if they did not personally know the people who live there. The Grosics were certain they left the gate open that night, so after providing Paul with directions to the farm, the perpetrators likely followed him there, and while he drove up the lane to the farmhouse, they took the opportunity to close the gate. And when Paul drove back down to the end of the lane, he likely climbed out of his car in order to reopen the gate, and his killers took this opportunity to ambush him. It seems obvious that Paul put up a fight and attempted to flee, since he was found in a field 50 yards away and had defensive wounds. I know there have always been rumors that the responsible parties did not initially plan on killing Paul and only wanted to rough him up until things escalated out of control and he wound up dead. Well, regardless of whether or not this scenario is true, it was still incredibly risky for them to go after Paul on private property, and it might just be pure luck that they've gotten away with this crime for 30 years. This might be nothing more than a coincidence, but I also find it interesting that Blue House Farm was located just over the county line, meaning that the Northumbria police would have jurisdiction over the investigation rather than the Durham Constabulary. Could the perpetrators have orchestrated things this way so that Paul's murder would not be investigated by the police force from his county? The Logan family has continuously offered a reward for information, and the amount has only increased over the years, but even though rumors have always circulated throughout the community, no one has ever come forward and helped provide the authorities with the necessary evidence to make an arrest. This is why there's always been speculation that certain people may have known the identities of the perpetrators, but have elected to keep their mouths shut for various reasons. Consett is not an overly large place, and while the descriptions of the two men seen at the phone box are pretty generic, there can only be a certain amount of people living in the area at that time who drove a red Ford Fiesta. I have to assume that police checked vehicle records and came up empty, or if they did find any potential suspects who drove a car matching that description, they just lacked the corroborating evidence to implicate that person. Over the past 3 decades, the only individual who has been publicly named as a potential suspect is Keith Suddock, and since he spent time in prison for arms dealing, I can understand why this may have helped spur the rumors about Paul's death being connected to organized crime. But otherwise, there have been very few details released about Suddock's potential involvement, and I definitely have a bunch of unanswered questions. All we know is that in 1997, a total of 10 men were taken into custody and questioned about Paul's murder, but they were released without charge. I would certainly like more information about who these 10 men were, but all we know is that one of them was Suddock, and just over 1 year later, he found himself in legal trouble for the bombing of Hugh Logan's van. I've read a few sources which state that Jeff Hunt, a police constable who worked on the investigation, had organized the bombing, but unfortunately, there's no additional information available about Hunt or what motive he would have had to do this. Suddock's rationale for his actions is that the Logan family had pretty much ruined his life by accusing him of being involved in Paul's murder, and really, there's no better way to demonstrate your innocence in a crime like that than by bombing a grieving father's van. I definitely feel there's a lot missing to this part of the story, but Suddock died in 2012, so if he was responsible for Paul's murder, he will never face justice for it. If Suddock was involved in the crime, and people were afraid to speak out against him, then it makes me wonder why his death wouldn't have prompted someone to come forward. Overall, I do think that all the theories about Paul's murder being a professional hit connected to organized crime may be overblown, but I still think this was a personal crime committed by someone with a major grudge against him. Regardless of the motive, this was still an incredibly brutal murder in which a husband and father was senselessly killed right before Christmas time, and whoever was responsible deserves to face justice. It seems like at least 2 people were involved, and this may be one of those cases in which all the authorities need in order to make an arrest is for the right person to come forward with information. So now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in 1994, and our second victim is 31-year-old Tracy Mertens, who originally hails from the town of Whitworth. Tracy has spent the past 15 years with her common-law husband, 34-year-old Joey Kavanaugh, and while the couple is never officially married, they have two children, a 12-year-old son named Daniel and an 11-year-old daughter named Kelly. However, Tracy and Joey had what could best be described as an up-and-down, on-and-off-again relationship, due largely to Joey's issues with drugs, but whenever they broke up, they would always manage to reconcile and get back together. In 1992, the couple made the surprising decision to take their two children and travel over 100 miles south to Birmingham, where they moved into a council house located on Cattle's Grove in the Neutrals Ward. They would remain there for the next 2 years, but during the summer of 1994, Tracy and her kids took a trip back up north to the city of Rochdale in order to spend a few weeks with Tracy's sister, Linda. According to Linda, Tracy told her that she had left Joey and didn't want him to know where she was. She also started exhibiting paranoid behavior, which included taping up the letterbox, the glass windows, and curtains at Linda's residence, and Tracy seemed to give off the impression that Joey's drug issues may have put her family at risk with some dangerous people. But in spite of this, Tracy ultimately decided to take her kids and return to Birmingham and reconcile with Joey. However, in mid-November, the couple made the sudden decision to move to Rochdale. While Tracy said she wanted to be closer to her family, the move happened so abruptly that there was speculation that something else may have been going on. One neighbor would later say that they saw a man shouting and banging on the front door of the family's residence in Birmingham, but Tracy refused to let him inside, and the family moved away a few days later, leaving many of their belongings behind. By December the 22nd, Tracy and Joey had not yet bought Christmas presents for their children, so she decided to take a bus trip back to their former residence in Birmingham. She was hoping to retrieve a benefits book which had been left there, so that she could use it to cash in her welfare benefits and buy some gifts. Placey had originally been planning to travel back to Rochdale that very same day, but after picking up the book, she decided to spend the night at her sister-in-law's place. She left there the following morning, and planned to make one final trip to the residence on Cattle's Grove in order to collect a few more belongings, but sometime within the next several hours, Tracy would become the victim of a horrific crime. At 4:10 p.m. on the afternoon of December the 23rd, a man was walking through a churchyard in the village of Eaton, located in County Cheshire, about 65 miles southeast of Birmingham, when he heard a female voice crying out in pain. The man soon discovered a horribly burned woman lying on the steps of Christ Church, and would later say that her burns looked so gruesome that he initially thought that she was wearing a bodysuit and makeup. He immediately called the police, and when they arrived at the scene, they discovered that the victim had burns on 95% of her body, which had almost completely destroyed her clothing, and the only parts which were not burned were the soles of her feet. The police would also find an empty 5-liter petrol can in the churchyard, which had presumably been used to set the woman on fire. Since she was still conscious, she was instantly rushed to North Staffordshire Royal Infirmary and eventually identified as Tracy Mertens. Due to the severe burns on her body, doctors had a hard time finding a blood vessel in order to administer medication. Remarkably, even though Tracy was in critical condition and experiencing indescribable pain, she was able to provide officers from the Cheshire Constabulary with a lucid and detailed account of what happened to her from her hospital bed. According to Tracy, after leaving her sister-in-law's residence that morning, she returned to her former house on Cattle's Grove and was collecting some belongings when she heard a knock at the front door at around 11:50 a.m. When Tracy opened the door, she said that two men came bursting in and yelled, quote, "Where's Joey?" She described them as being a pair of overweight black men in their early 30s who had West Midlands accents and wore brown leather baseball-style caps and thigh-high leather coats. When they realized Joey was not there, they proceeded to blindfold Tracy and drag her outside before placing her in a vehicle and driving away. Throughout the drive, Tracy said that she heard the two men arguing in a foreign language which sounded like a Jamaican dialect, and police would later express their belief that they were speaking Jamaican patois. While she was in captivity, Tracy's abductors continued to ask her where Joey was, but she refused to tell them because her kids might have been with Joey at that time and she didn't want to jeopardize their safety. They eventually stopped at Christchurch in Eton, and when Tracy's blindfold was removed, she noticed that her captors had been driving a yellow Mark II Ford Escort, which had a cuddly toy stuck to the back window. The two men then dragged Tracy into the churchyard, where they proceeded to empty out an entire petrol can onto her body before setting her on fire and burning her alive. When the assailants fled the scene, Tracy managed to douse the flames and crawl over to the church steps before help arrived. After providing her statement to police, Tracy drifted in and out of consciousness and held on for as long as she could, but she passed away during the early morning hours of Christmas Eve, approximately 12 hours after she was set on fire. Investigators were unable to attach any significance to Christchurch in Eton or figure out why Tracy's two abductors chose this location to set her on fire, so it was possible it was selected completely at random. Another detail Tracy had shared is that while she was blindfolded and being tossed into the Escort in Birmingham, she thought she heard a random man ask if everyone was all right before they drove away. Since this man was a potentially important witness to Tracy's abduction, police sent out a public plea for him to come forward, but as far as I can tell, he never did. When investigators visited Tracy's former residence in Birmingham, they discovered that someone had scrawled the word death on a downstairs window, though this may have been done during the time period between when the family moved out in mid-November and Tracy returned there. It was also reported that a search of the house turned up some heroin inside the light fittings, and while this initially caused the British tabloids to push forward the angle that Tracy's murder was related to drugs, police eventually confirmed that there was nothing to indicate that she was involved in criminal activity, and they believed Tracy was an innocent victim who was likely in the wrong place at the wrong time. Of course, given Joey's past issues with drugs, and the fact that Tracy's killers had asked for him when they abducted her, rumors circulated that she was murdered over a drug debt that Joey owed. In fact, a couple would later come forward with a story about how they owed someone money for drugs, and were told that if they did not pay up, they would experience the same thing which had happened to Tracy Mertens. When Joey was questioned by investigators, he denied the allegations that he owed a drug debt, and maintained that he had no idea who Tracy's two killers were or what their motive was for the crime. Regardless, Tracy's death would sour the relationship between Joey and her family, as they would take custody of the two children, Daniel and Kelly, and look after them. In January of 1995, it was reported that two men from Birmingham were being held for questioning for their alleged roles in Tracy's murder. One of them, whose name was never released publicly, was released on bail, but the other, 28-year-old Derek Sylvester Johnson, was charged with conspiracy to commit murder. When Johnson appeared in magistrate's court to face the charge, he was in a wheelchair with a heavily plastered left arm and a heavily bandaged right arm. When Johnson's solicitor spoke to the press, he denied his client's involvement in the murder and claimed he had never even heard of Tracy Mertens. Johnson's solicitor also claimed that he had previously suffered injuries in a road accident, which were worsened when he was mistreated by the West Midlands police during his arrest. As a result, Johnson required hospitalization and was planning to file a formal complaint. Johnson remained in custody for the next 3 months, but by the end of April, the case against him was dropped and he was released due to insufficient evidence. His solicitor said that Johnson was planning to sue the police over his mistreatment, but I was unable to find any further information about how the situation turned out. In March of 1996, the case would be featured on an episode of the BBC Two documentary series Modern Times. The episode was titled Tracy and Joy, and continued to explore the scenario that Tracy was murdered over something her spouse had been involved in. Joy agreed to be interviewed on the show, but continued to maintain that he had no idea why Tracy was killed or who was responsible. While he admitted to having taken drugs in the past, he denied ever having been involved with the selling or dealing of drugs. After the documentary aired, Joey would tell the press that the negative publicity caused him to receive threats and abuse, and he was forced to move out of Rochdale. He also accused the filmmakers of twisting the facts to paint him in a negative light. For example, even though Tracy's killers had supposedly said, "Where's Joey?" when they abducted her, Joey claimed that his own sister had overheard Tracy sharing this part of the story with the police, and she actually told him that the perpetrators yelled out, quote, "Where's your man?" rather than referring to him by name. This is why Joy believed that Tracy may have been the victim of mistaken identity. In November of 1997, an inquest was held about Tracy's death, in which Cheshire coroner John Hibbert rendered an open verdict, which angered her family and caused Tracy's brother, Mark Mertens, to openly cry out, quote, "You can't do that," before storming out of the courtroom. Mark then told the press, quote, "He should have brought an unlawful killing verdict. There is no way he could bring an open verdict on the evidence we've seen," end quote. In response, Hibbert said that while he did believe the story that Tracy shared about being abducted by two men and burned alive, it could not be corroborated by any evidence or independent eyewitnesses, which is why he could not officially rule it to be an unlawful killing. In spite of this verdict, police still investigated Tracy's death as a homicide and conducted thousands of interviews, but even though a £30,000 reward was offered for information leading to a conviction, her two alleged killers could not be positively identified. For years, Daniel and Kelly wrote poems about their mother's murder, which would be published in various newspapers around Christmas time, alongside fresh appeals for people to come forward. In December of 2009, on the 15-year anniversary of Tracy's death, police announced that advances in DNA technology had allowed them to put together a DNA profile for at least one of the perpetrators, which was taken from evidence such as the empty petrol can and a tiny blood stain which was found inside the residence where Tracy was abducted. But while this DNA profile helped investigators eliminate some suspects, it has yet to be matched to anyone. Around this time period, the case was featured on an episode of Crime Watch, but even though this apparently led to someone phoning in an anonymous tip where they provided the name of one of the killers, as well as their motive, the lead did not go anywhere. One final note is that if you go to the Web Sleuths forum, you'll find a thread about this case in which Tracy's son Daniel left a couple of comments to confirm that Joey Kavanaugh passed away in June of 2020, and until the day of his death, Joey never stopped maintaining that he had no idea who was responsible for the crime. So after 3 decades, the murder of Tracy Mertens continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So even though the two cases aren't connected, there are a number of parallels that can be made between the murders of Paul Logan and Tracy Mertens. Both victims had 2 children with their longtime common law partner, even though the couples never officially married, and they wound up being violently attacked 2 days before Christmas. What's also sad is that the families of both these victims repeatedly told the media that their murders pretty much ruined Christmas for them, as the painful memories of what happened left them in no mood to celebrate every year. And I'm sure the situation was extra difficult, knowing that the killers were still out there. Both these crimes involved at least 2 perpetrators who murdered the victim at locations where there was a risk of getting caught, yet there were no witnesses to what happened. And there have always been rumors that people know the identities of these killers, but have kept their mouths shut and allowed the crimes to go unsolved for 3 decades. However, the key difference between the 2 crimes is that Paul may have been killed over something he was involved in, whereas Tracy may have been killed over something that her spouse, Joey Kavanaugh, was involved in. However, even though it was no secret that Joey had a number of personal issues, he always denied knowing the identities of Tracy's killers, and since he apparently passed away over 3 years ago, who knows what secrets he may have taken to his grave. I am definitely inclined to believe that the 2 men who killed Tracy were after Joey, but there's still a number of things about their actions which don't make much sense, and so many unanswered questions. It's not often that this podcast gets the opportunity to cover a cold case in which a murder victim managed to share what happened to them before they died, and considering how badly Tracy was burned and the amount of pain she must have been in, it's pretty miraculous that she was able to provide so many details. In fact, she provided so many specific details about the perpetrators and their vehicle that it does seem surprising that no one has been able to figure out who they are. But you also have to take into account that due to the condition she was in, there is a possibility that some of the information Tracy shared may not have been accurate or could have even been misunderstood by those who heard her story. I only bring this up because Tracy said that the 2 men who abducted her specifically asked, "Where's Joey?" But Joey claimed that this statement was misconstrued. I mean, I suppose it's possible that Tracy was the victim of mistaken identity and was attacked by people whom she had no connection with, but I think that theory goes out the window if they specifically use Joey's name. Tracy said that she did not tell these men where Joy was because she was worried about the safety of her children, and that's just a detail which rings true. In fact, I'm sure the main reason that Tracy was so motivated to share her story while she was in such pain was because she wanted to get the perpetrators off the street before her kids wound up in serious danger. There were definitely a number of warning signs that something was going on with Joey in the weeks prior to Tracy's murder. I mentioned earlier that the couple had a fairly troubled, on-again, off-again relationship, which was largely the result of Joey's drug use, and during the summer of 1994, Tracy took their children and stayed with her sister for a few weeks while displaying paranoid behavior during that time period. While it almost seemed like this might finally prompt Tracy to break up with Joey for good, they did stick together, but then made the sudden decision to move from Birmingham to Rochdale in mid-November. Now, the reasoning for why they moved to Rochdale makes sense, since this would allow Tracy to be closer to her family, but the major red flag was how abrupt their move was, as they left numerous belongings behind in Birmingham. We also have the eyewitness report of Tracy having a confrontation at her door with an unidentified man right before she moved, so this is why it's easy to believe the rumors that Joey had some sort of drug debt or cross paths with some dangerous people, which necessitated the family's decision to leave the area as quickly as possible. The main reason Tracy returned to Birmingham on December the 22nd was to collect a benefits book that she needed to receive money to buy Christmas gifts for her children, but the fact that such an important item was left there to begin with indicates that they needed to get out of there in a big hurry. It sounds like Tracy was originally planning to return to Rochdale immediately after she collected the booklet, but decided to stay in Birmingham overnight with her sister-in-law and returned to her former residence to pick up additional belongings on December the 23rd. And that only adds to the tragedy, because if Tracy had gone back to Rochdale on the 22nd as she had originally planned, she may never have crossed paths with her killers. But that only begs the question, since Tracy was not planning to visit this house on the 23rd, how did the killers know she was going to be there that day? If they had been following her all the way from Rochdale, why wouldn't they abduct her on the 22nd? Is it just bad luck that Tracy decided to stop by the house around the same time those two men happened to check it out? Now, when I read that Tracy spent the evening of the 22nd with her sister-in-law, I initially thought they were referring to Joey's sister, and made me wonder if perhaps she told the perpetrators that Tracy was going back to her former house that morning. But from my research, it sounds like this sister-in-law was not related to Joey, but was actually the wife of Tracy's brother, in which case, it's very unlikely that she set Tracy up to be abducted. But again, if these two men were after Joey and had not been following Tracy, then it's just horrible luck that they happened to show up at the house when Tracy was there. The couple had been moved out for about 5 weeks at that point, so what are the odds of them deciding to check there on that particular date? So, there was some controversy 3 years later, when an inquest was held, and coroner John Hibbert rendered an open verdict on Tracy's death, rather than ruling it to be an unlawful killing. For clarification, this does not mean that Hibbert believed Tracy poured petrol all over her body and set herself on fire, and then completely fabricated a story about being abducted by two black men. Yes, there are documented cases in which people will set themselves on fire as a manner of suicide, but this scenario obviously makes no logical sense here, since Tracy was burned in a village located 65 miles outside of Birmingham, and she had no transportation to get there on her own. The coroner confirmed that he did believe Tracy's story about what happened, but could not conclusively rule it to be a homicide, since there were no independent eyewitnesses to verify Tracy's story. And yes, even though a number of people found Tracy after she was set on fire, it does not sound like there was anyone who could confirm having seen her with two black men. Tracy did say that while she was blindfolded and being placed inside her abductor's car in Birmingham, she heard a man asking if everything was okay, but I do not believe this man ever came forward and spoke to police. And that's a shame, because he may have been able to provide a more detailed description of the perpetrators, as they've never released any composite sketches of them based on Tracy's description. Again, there is no reason to believe that the story Tracy shared wasn't true, but there definitely seemed to be some major gaps in the timeline of events. To recap, Tracy said she was abducted from Birmingham at around 11:50 a.m., and her burned body was discovered on the steps of Christ Church in Eton at 4:10 p.m. But the problem is that it takes only about an hour and a half to drive from Birmingham to Eton, So where was Tracy during the remainder of this 4-hour window? Did these men take her elsewhere and try to get her to reveal Joy's whereabouts? If so, did Tracy share additional details about what happened during that time period? Is there certain information about Tracy's story which the police have intentionally withheld from the public in order to weed out false tips and confessions? I know Tracy was blindfolded when she was abducted, but it's not clear when exactly her blindfold was removed. If this did not take place until she arrived in Eaton, she may not have even known where she was during those 4 hours. But another big unanswered question is why exactly did they stop at this particular churchyard in Eaton in order to set Tracy on fire? Investigators cannot figure out any significance about the location and thought it may have been chosen at random, but even so, why drive 65 miles to begin with? It was also a big risk to set Tracy on fire at a public location in broad daylight, since they easily could have been seen by witnesses. A possible explanation is that they may have wanted to make a public spectacle of Tracy's death in order to send a message to others that this sort of thing could happen if you crossed them or did not pay off your drug debts. But Eaton is a very small village on the outskirts of Congleton, and it had a population of less than 300 people back then, so it does not strike me as a place which was rampant with drug activity. If the perpetrators were from Birmingham and wanted to send some sort of message, why not kill Tracy there? Tracy's description of how the two men were speaking made investigators believe they were Jamaican, so it's been suspected that they were Yardies, a term which is often used to describe Jamaican gangs or organized crime groups. Yardies were responsible for a lot of crime in the United Kingdom during the 1990s, which was often connected to drugs. So if they believed that Joey Kavanaugh had wronged them and could not find him, then I could definitely see these guys inflicting violence on his spouse. But again, what made them choose Eaton as a spot to commit such a brutal murder? Joey continually maintained that he had no idea who these two men were and denied being involved with anything that would have made him a target for violent Yardies. It's easy to be skeptical of Joy's claims, but it's worth noting that I haven't read anything about him being attacked or targeted by any criminal figures after Tracy's death, though he did go into hiding for a while. From my perspective, if I was involved in something illegal or had a drug debt to some dangerous people, and then learned that someone had abducted the mother of my children and burned her alive, I would be inclined to come clean about everything and seek protection from the police, no matter what legal consequences I might face. But then Joy may not have had these same moral standards and thought it would be better to remain silent, even if his own children could have potentially been at risk. What is odd is that Tracy gave a very distinctive description of the car her killers drove, as she said it was a yellow Mark II Ford Escort, and it even had a cuddly toy stuck to the back window. You would have to think there would be a limited amount of Jamaican men from the Birmingham area who drove a yellow Escort, but not only have the men remained unidentified, the vehicle has as well. Again, I do have to add the disclaimer that due to the state Tracy was in when she shared her story, she may have misremembered or miscommunicated certain details, or the investigators misheard her, so perhaps the description of the car was not 100% accurate. But it's also possible that a number of people knew exactly who these two men were, but given the level of violence they were capable of, everyone was too scared to come forward. The only person who has ever been named as a potential suspect was a man named Derek Sylvester Johnson, who was held in custody for 3 months after being charged with conspiracy to commit murder, but was released due to lack of evidence. Johnson alleged that he suffered serious injuries as a result of police brutality and was planning to sue them for their actions, but I was unable to find any information about how this lawsuit turned out, and Johnson's name has not been mentioned since he was released in 1995. None of the sources I've seen mentioned if Johnson was Jamaican or black, but remember, he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, which implies that he may not have been one of the two men who personally killed Tracy, but was still somehow involved in the crime. Unfortunately, no details were publicly released about who Johnson was, if he had any connection to Tracy or Joey, or why investigators believed he was involved in the murder. Johnson was also taken into custody alongside a second man who was released without being charged, but no information was shared about this person or their potential involvement. Now, within the past 15 years, police have announced that they do have DNA evidence, which was apparently collected from the empty container used to douse Tracy with petrol and a blood spot found at a residence in Birmingham. The reason it took so long to test the blood spot is because it was apparently quite small, and since there was a danger of the testing completely consuming it, investigators wanted to wait for the necessary advancements in DNA profiling before they went through with it. It sounds like this DNA was useful for excluding suspects, and I'd be curious to know if it was ever compared with Derek Sylvester Johnson's DNA. But then again, if Johnson only conspired to orchestrate the murder and was not personally involved, then the results of any DNA testing for him may not mean anything. It's worth noting that unlike North America, the United Kingdom has not yet adopted genetic genealogy as a crime-solving tool. While DNA evidence from criminal cases in the UK can be compared to offenders whose DNA has already been entered into the system, things are not yet at the point where evidence can just be entered into a genealogy database and compared to anyone who has submitted their DNA. So as of right now, the DNA from this case has yet to be matched to anyone. Much like Paul Logan's murder, I think there may be a culture of fear surrounding this case, where even though 3 decades have passed, people who might know the identity of the perpetrators are reluctant to share this information with police. But while Paul Logan may have been targeted and murdered by enemies with a personal grudge against him, that does not seem to be the case with Tracy Mertens, who was likely an innocent victim that was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. She may have been killed over something her spouse was involved with, and if the crime was somehow connected to Joy Kavanaugh, there was always the possibility that his death may have compelled people to open up, but he passed away 3 years ago, and this is yet to take place. All we know for certain is that both victims profiled here today left behind 2 children who are now grown adults, and still haven't received conclusive answers about why their parent was murdered, and they definitely deserve justice. So if you happen to have any information on the murders of Paul Logan or Tracy Mertens, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released an episode about the disappearances of 2 men named Mel Wilson and Richard Lepsey, as their respective families have explored the possibility that one of these men may have gone on to become the infamous unidentified hijacker known only as D.B. Cooper. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spit-out podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my 2 co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the 1990 disappearance of 3 men who vanished after the sinking of a fishing boat known as the Casey and Nicole. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I also just wanted to mention that if we manage to reach our goal of 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of 2023, we will provide an additional extra special bonus to all of our patrons in January. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Jack, Human Frailty, and Amy R. Thank you all so much for your support. In addition, I wanted to remind everyone that this coming Saturday, December the 16th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be holding one of our annual Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. If you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes and pinned to the top of our social media pages. Once again, it's taking place this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. Also, since we covered a couple of British cases this week, I wanted to remind everyone that The Trail Went Cold has once again been booked to appear on Podcast Row at CrimeCon UK next year, which is taking place in London on September the 21st and 22nd of 2024. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, please visit their website at crimecon.co.uk and use our specialized promo code COLD24 to get a 10% discount on tickets. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk, and the promo code is COLD24 for 10% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us again next Wednesday for this year's final holiday-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.